Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green, and we're going to begin this week with a job change in Washington.
To lead my Republican colleagues has been the highest privilege. But one of life's most underappreciated talents is to know when it's time to move on to life's next chapter. So I stand before you today, Mr. President, and my colleagues, to say this will be my last term as Republican leader of the Senate. I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. However, I'll complete my job my colleagues have given me until we select a new leader in November and they take the helm next January.
That is the voice of Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who announced that he's going to be stepping down from his post. McConnell will finish out his term as senator through January of 2027, but he's going to lead his post as Republican leader. He led the Senate GOP for a record-setting 17 years. McConnell cited a shift in party politics as a key reason for stepping down, though there had also been health concerns dating back to last year for the 82-year-old senator who was first elected as a senator from Kentucky in 1984. So let's talk about this moment. We have our regular panel with us. Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, was communications director for the Democratic National Committee and advisor to Hillary Clinton, and Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch. She is a lawyer and was spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Wow, you think about just, you know, the voices you never think you're going to not be hearing much from in Washington, D.C., and McConnell has just been such a fixture through so many moments and world events and presidencies. I know he's, you know, staying in his role as senator, but not having him leading the Republican Party, this it feels like quite a moment that says a lot about our national politics. Sarah, what do you think about when you reflect on what's happening right now with the Republican leader?
Mostly I'm thinking how old I am, because I absolutely remember Bill Frist and that
so
era.
So do I. I mean, that's fair.
Of the Senate. And so it's like, oh, we're at the end of this era that I remember the previous era. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
But absolutely, McConnell was a big change from Frist in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think what will be most remembered about the McConnell era is actually the McConnell-Reid era, where Harry Reid was his counterpart on the Democratic side, and their focus on the judiciary as in some ways a political weapon that they were using against one another, and the sort of increasing aggressive maneuvers that each took. Harry Reid, of course, got rid of the filibuster for the first time for lower court judges. McConnell then following suit with Supreme Court justices then 5 years later, and both blaming the other sides for why they needed to do that. And I think it's really hurt the judiciary. I think it has made Americans believe that it's more politicized. I think it has changed sort of the focus of law students and lawyers who want to become judges in the first place to not have that filibuster. You know, instead of needing votes from the other side and being sort of the most conservative or most liberal pick who could get confirmed, instead, the fear is actually that you're not going to be accepted by your own side. And so it moves judges to sort of the judges who get picked to the flanks of their two political parties, which I think has been bad for the judiciary, or I should phrase will be bad for the judiciary over time, because it's only been 10 years since Reid got rid of the filibuster for the vast majority of federal judges. And we've only had four picks for the Supreme Court since the end of the Supreme Court filibuster. But I think that will be the legacy. Sort of seeing the judiciary as this all-out focus where legislation got ignored, cabinet member confirmations got ignored, all to focus on judges and the effect that that will have on the third branch.
Mm. Mo, what do you think about when we bring up the word legacy and Mitch McConnell?
I mean, I guess a couple of things. One, I think objectively he will go down in history as one of the most consequential Senate majority leaders. I mean, his ability to sort of identify an agenda and push it through is really unmatched in the Senate in the modern era. His ability, which in recent years started to weaken a bit, but his ability to get a majority of his of the Senate Republicans behind an idea and push it through. He was a master of the legislative process, or is a master of the legislative process in a way that maybe we haven't seen as effectively since LBJ was the Senate Majority Leader. So I think he's going to be seen in a as in sort of an elite category of effective Senate leaders. Look, as someone who is left of center, I think his substantive legacy is going to be seen as very, very mixed. I mean, he's a true conservative, at least the way we used to define conservative. And he made no bones about that. He made no bones about the fact that he wanted to reshape the judiciary to be right of center. He set that, he wanted that to be his legacy. And I agree with Sarah that it will be his legacy. There are some out there who call him an institutionalist. I'm not as sold on that as others are. I don't see him as being the protector of the institution of the Senate the way some others do. I think, you know, we can go back and forth, and I'm sure Sarah and I would, on the whole escalation on the judiciary. But taking it to the level he did, blocking Merrick Garland from even receiving a hearing in the Senate when there was really no reason to not give him a hearing, like, to me, that really degraded the institution in a very consequential way. At the same time, I do appreciate the fact that he did try, particularly in the most recent years, to keep the conservative movement intact in the Senate, not surrender it entirely to the MAGA movement, because those two things are not the same.
Right.
And the way he stood up and defended foreign aid this past year is admirable. But at the end of the day, as much as his ability to push a conservative agenda will, I think, be part of his legacy, the fact that he's presided over a Senate that saw the decimation of the old guard conservative movement, because not even the vaunted Mitch McConnell knew how to navigate the Donald Trump era, I think that will also be part of his legacy.
Well, and he talked about that a little bit. I mean, hinting that he doesn't totally look forward to trying to navigate this new era in the Republican Party, because I mean, to me, part of McConnell's legacy is maybe not even protecting the institution as much as he was protecting the party and its power. I mean, when we would talk about, you know, in the newsroom, you know, what was motivating McConnell? I mean, obviously he has a, you know, he has ideology, he has beliefs, but, you know, holding on to power and that majority in the Senate was so vital to him. And that's why I think this moment, as I watch McConnell and these comments, is so interesting to me, because he brought up national security, and I want to play a little bit of his voice again, but I'm wondering if there's a shift here from, you know, a pillar in our politics for so long who was committed to party and to a Republican majority, and now he's committed to an issue and philosophy and a worldview. I mean, and I wonder if he is now going to have some space and some cover to fight for foreign aid to Ukraine, and be much more committed to issues that really he feels to his core in these final years of public service, and not so much, you know, being committed to, I need to make sure that the party remains in power. So I just want to play a little more of what he said as he was stepping down, and we can talk about it.
I think back to my first days in the Senate with deep appreciation for the time that helped shape my view of the world. I'm unconflicted about the good within our country and the irreplaceable role we play as the leader of the free world. It's why I worked so hard to get the national security package passed earlier this month. Believe me, I know the politics within my party at this particular moment in time. I have many faults. Misunderstanding politics is not one of them.
I mean, I don't know. What I hear there is McConnell saying, I don't want to lead this party right now, but I have beliefs that have meant so much to me for so long. They include, you know, the United States playing a certain role in the world, and he's ready to fight for that in a different way. But what do you both hear?
So first of all, you'll note that Mitch McConnell has not endorsed Donald Trump for president in 2024, as so many other members have, senators and congressmen, most notably John Thune just a few days ago. And we haven't talked yet about who's likely to replace Mitch McConnell, but there's three Johns vying for it, basically. John Barrasso, John Cornyn, and John Thune. Notably, John Thune is not considered a Trump person at all, certainly not a MAGA person at all. And so when John Thune endorsed Trump a few days ago, there was already scuttlebutt that for whatever reason, Thune thought that he was in the running to be minority leader here in short order. And I mention that because I think, to your point, David, what I'll be watching most closely for over the next 6 months is whether McConnell endorses Trump or whether he says, I'm not doing that sort of campaign strategy stuff anymore. What I'm doing is focusing on these last few loose ends, these issues that are most important to me. All of my effort is going to that right now and nothing else. That being said, he said he's going to be minority leader through the end of the election. So maybe not. We'll see. And don't
you think
forget,
there's a chance he might not endorse Trump?
It's interesting he hasn't done it so far and that Thune jumped out real quick. I think he probably will, like I said, because he's going to be minority leader through the election. I don't see how he cannot endorse the Republican nominee by any means. But McConnell has had a really fraught relationship with these guys. And the House Freedom Caucus, put out this statement saying that Mitch McConnell was the Democrat from Ukraine. You know, Trump's son referred to McConnell as Mitch the Glitch, something like that, making fun of his health.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You could see McConnell YOLO it. The problem is you mentioned these policy issues that he cares about, and he absolutely does. But there's this other half of McConnell who is a master political strategist in the form of some of the sort of great political figures through like the world's history. McConnell may go down as in terms of that strategy. You know, Mo mentions the Garland thing of not bringing up Garland for confirmation. Absolutely. I've fully acknowledged. I understand why the left is upset about that. And I think it did hurt the institution of the judiciary, actually. But if you just look at it from a political standpoint, it was a brilliant move and arguably handed Donald Trump the 2016 election.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with that at all. Look, how McConnell navigates Trump in whatever time he's left in the Senate, right? Whether it's the final months of his leadership or the final 2 years of his Senate term, because he said he's going to stay on through the end of the term, at least. You know, I mean, here's a guy who everybody celebrated on the left post January 6th for being unequivocal in his blame of Donald Trump, his assigning of responsibility for the insurrection directly at the feet of Donald Trump. He could not have been more clear in his rhetoric. But when it came to taking action on it, he chose not to. And I understand the politics of why, but he chose not to. And when asked if Donald Trump were to be the nominee again, would you support him? He has said, I will support the Republican nominee for president. And so, you know, for those reasons, like it was a complete and total capitulation to the reality of where the Republican Party is today. Which is why I'm not surprised at all that John Thune, who is, by all accounts, no fan of Donald Trump, endorsed. Frankly, the only surprise to me was how long it took for John Thune to endorse Donald Trump for president. Because if even Mitch McConnell is saying, I'm going to support him if he's the nominee, right? It just tells you where we are. And now you've got three guys who are likely to throw their hat into the ring. One, I think, already sort of has, John Cornyn. As much as people on the left are wary of Mitch McConnell, maybe relieved to see him go, I think there is also fear about what comes next.
Yeah.
Because, and I think Joe Biden said it well. Joe Biden said, I'm sorry to see Mitch go because he was an honest broker. I at least knew where he was coming from at any given moment. And I had a good relationship working with him because I could trust what he was going to say to me. We're now entering an era where, you know, Mitch McConnell was still willing to stand up to Trump at times on some issues. But he at least told you what he was going to do. This is now a caucus that is not as open and not as willing to buck their likely nominee for president. And the three men who are vying to replace him are squarely in that group.
Mo and Sarah, and I'll be back to talk a little bit more about McConnell, and then we're going to turn to how the two parties are trying to deal with the chaos at the U.S. southern border, which is becoming more of a priority for voters, we're learning now. We'll be back with more Left, Right, and Center. We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. We've been talking about Mitch McConnell announcing that he's going to step down as Senate Republican leader at the end of this year. And, you know, I think back to an interview that McConnell actually did with my then colleague at Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep. It was a long interview about McConnell's book, The Long Game. So this is 2016. This is as the Obama presidency is ending, and Steve was talking to McConnell about his approach to leadership.
What I have said is when the American people elect divided government, what are they saying? I think they're saying, we know you have differences of opinion on big things, but why don't you look for the things you can agree on and do those? And that has been the way I have run this new majority.
So McConnell, in that conversation, he talked about making deals with then Vice President Joe Biden and said that he and Biden worked together on what McConnell said were some of the biggest bipartisan deals during the Obama era, the extension of the Bush tax cuts. There were several big budget deals. And here's my question for the two of you, Mo, Sarah. Like, I'm having this moment right now as McConnell makes this announcement where it's like my initial impulse was, oh my God, like one of the people who actually cared about getting along and making deals and cooperating is stepping down. Oh God, where are we going from here? Can't we get more people like McConnell back who want to make deals and talk across the aisle? But like, do American voters want that? Are politicians who want to reach across the aisle and make deals, like, are they going to be rewarded by voters? Or do I and many of us just need to accept that we're in a different reality now?
This is where I actually think both sides hating on the Supreme Court are missing the opportunity here. And let me use the example that we just saw in Alabama. The Alabama Supreme Court held that an Alabama statute basically allowed people to get, you know, civil liabilities, civil suits against providers of IVF if an embryo was destroyed. And as a result, the Alabama legislature is now going to pass a bill. It just passed the House in Alabama. It's going to the Senate, where it's expected to pass. Basically saying, nope, you got it wrong. Here's another bill. We're going to make very clear if that piece of legislation was ambiguous from, I think it was 1872, this will not be. All IVF providers are provided all liability from civil and criminal penalties. That's actually how things are supposed to work. You're not supposed to just, you know, everything rides on the Supreme Court and you either get your way or you lose and that's the end. What's supposed to happen is that you win or lose at the Supreme Court and then you go to Congress. And my hope is that Alabama provides a little bit of a lesson here and a roadmap, because the political pressure after the Alabama Supreme Court found that was then on the legislature to fix it. And what we've seen at the national level is none of that pressure, because the Supreme Court is seen as the final arbiter, and the headlines that we see from the media are Supreme Court strikes down gun control regulation, or Supreme Court strikes down student loan debt forgiveness, or Supreme Court strikes down climate change regulation. And in fact, it should have been, it's Congress's job to do student loan debt relief. It's Congress's job to pass that gun control legislation. It's Congress's job to deal with climate change. I hope that that is where we will head, that the pendulum will get so far gone, with McConnell is only the last of many people leaving Congress who were actually interested in legislating, because there's no point in being there. Because you're right, David, voters don't see that as the place to fix their problems. They see the courts as the place to fix their problems. My hope is that voters will increase the pressure on Congress and stop seeing the presidency as this four-year pendulum to get everything they want, but only for 4 years. And then the next 4 years, everything gets taken away and we act like the world's falling apart, when it's always been Congress that was supposed to do it.
Yeah, look, I 100% agree with Sarah that if Congress did its job, we would be in a very different place. But people don't trust Congress. And sticking with the IVF example, right? The Alabama Supreme Court showed the risk in leaving that particular issue entirely up to states, which was the whole point of overturning Roe v. Wade, was to throw all these issues back to the states. The Alabama Supreme Court showed the risk to a lot of families in throwing it back to the states. And so the Democrats in Congress introduced legislation to protect IVF, nothing else, not touching anything else in abortion, just protecting IVF. And all the Republicans who in the days leading up had rushed to say how much they support IVF, refused to back it. Not a single Republican member of the Senate, to my knowledge, came out and said they support it, saying, no, this should be a state issue. And so it's understandable why a lot of people, I think, would look at that and say, hold up, if Congress isn't going to touch these issues that they're supposed to, if the legislative branch isn't going to touch these issues, then we need some relief and we want it to come from somewhere, and maybe that's the court. But if the court's not going to do it, where do we go? And that's where people are really losing faith. They don't know where to go for relief on some of these things. And to your bigger question, David, I have cited ad nauseum on the show polling on this issue. I won't go through the numbers again, but the one thing the polling shows is that no, people don't necessarily want compromise.
Right.
When they say they want compromise, what they are saying is they want the other side to compromise. And we see how that is playing out, right? The fact that the Biden administration gave Republicans much of what they were asking for in this border deal, and you saw Republican House members stand up and say, if Democrats are for it, it's not good enough.
I just want to make the point that Mo's right, but it was worse. They actually would prefer to do it through the executive branch.
Well, listen, I think that's why I really want to dig into the issue of immigration, because I think it is a perfect venue to explore some of these bigger questions that we are asking. Like, do voters want Congress to come together and actually both sides compromise to come up with solutions? Mo, I think you pointed out that in a lot of cases, voters just want one side to compromise and it's the other side. I mean, Sarah, you're pointing out that maybe people don't want Congress. Maybe they want, you know, the president or the Supreme Court, these other branches of government to deal with these problems, which carries its own risks. And so I want to dig into immigration, especially because polls are now showing that more Americans are prioritizing some kind of solution at the border, some kind of solution. But, you know, as we talk about what exactly do they want, and it's not surprising as we see these polls showing voter interest in immigration. We had both President Biden and Donald Trump spending time along the border this past week. But so far, we're seeing mostly a blame game, I think. President Biden blaming Trump and his Republican allies, like you said, Mo, for scuttling this bipartisan deal that the president supported that had a lot of enforcement and security measures that Republicans like. And you have Trump and, you know, and his allies blaming President Biden for what Trump says are failed policies that have led to the mess that we're seeing. So, you know, I really do want to dig into this. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW, and we're going to talk about immigration here. And let me ask both of you first, are you surprised that immigration has risen to kind of the top of the priority list for voters?
I am surprised. You know, we've seen blips of that before, like for a month where it's really in the news. But overall, of course, voters have generally said it's the economy, inflation, government not working, et cetera. Immigration actually is a problem that's broken. And the Supreme Court has been very clear through both the Trump presidency and the Biden presidency that they do not have the power to fix the main problems that cause our immigration crisis at the border. And so it will have to be fixed by Congress. And I love this because this is the wolf, right? Things are going to be chaotic. The crisis may get worse, but at some point it's sort of like only offering your toddler broccoli. And they're like, yeah, but I'm only going to eat pizza and cookies. And you're like, well, there's only broccoli. Well, I'll only eat pizza and cookies. And you're like, cool. Eventually you'll get hungry. Eventually you'll eat the broccoli and you'll have to eat it. And that's what compromise is right now. It's like, but I love broccoli. I think broccoli is delicious. But imagine bad tasting broccoli. But eventually they're going to have to get hungry and eat the compromise on immigration, which I think will be very good because once you eat the broccoli and realize it's secretly delicious, especially with cheese sauce, then maybe you'll be willing to try more vegetables down the road. I've really done a lot of metaphors here. Forgive me. But
cheese sauce, any vegetable with cheese sauce. I mean, I'm totally in. I don't know what metaphor that helps us with, but yeah.
But you know, you have Republicans saying, well, when Trump gets into office, he can use, I think it's 212F in the code that basically says the president has enormous power to simply stop immigration. And it's like, oh, no, guys. You tried that in the last Trump administration. It was blocked by the courts. Biden saying that he's going to now try basically the same thing that Trump tried during his administration that was already blocked by the courts. By all means, please, because then it will show both the left and the right that it simply is not in the president's power to do this. Congress has to change the asylum laws that were passed in the 80s as sort of a post-World War II fix to the shame that we experienced when so many Jews were turned away from Europe. You have to change that law. The president can't change the law. Like, I feel like it's, you know, I need to do Schoolhouse Rock for voters and, frankly, these Republican talking heads and Democratic talking heads who keep saying like, ah, well, this has never worked for anyone before, but what if we try it? Like, nope, it's still not going to work.
But isn't this what we've seen when it comes to the immigration debate for years now? This idea that, well, it's going to get so chaotic and dangerous that voters are going to have to acknowledge that there needs to be some kind of compromise. It's not happening. I mean,
no, voters, actually, this is one issue where I think the mainstream, right, to go back on something I said earlier, where the mainstream actually does want a compromise. It is a compromise that the left absolutely hates, right? It is a compromise that there were far more progressive activists upset with the bipartisan border deal that Biden was prepared to sign than there were far-right activists. But there is a compromise out there that the public would be happy with. This is where politics gets in the way. And this is where sort of our broken partisanship gets in the way. Because while a majority of voters would have liked to have seen that bill passed, a majority of MAGA voters didn't want to see it passed because Donald Trump told them he didn't want to see it passed. Forget the fact that much of it was stuff that they had explicitly been asking for. So, you know, there is an opportunity for compromise at times if we can change the incentive structure. Because right now, and we have talked about this ad nauseum on the show before as well, and one of the areas where I think Sarah and I are in complete agreement is that the incentive structure favors polarization. It favors base-oriented politics. Joe Biden went out on a limb with his own base here. He signed on to a proposal that the left absolutely hates and that most people on the left question whether or not it would ever work.
And he didn't get it anyway.
And he still couldn't get it.
I want to ask you something, and I think this is a space where you and Sarah will not agree. When I hear Donald Trump criticize Joe Biden and his immigration policy, one first reaction is, like, you and your allies scuttled the bipartisan deal that Joe Biden supported. Like, let's look forward and find solutions. Why are we looking backwards? But, you know, I read this piece by David Leonhardt in the New York Times, and, you know, he said that Biden has been aggressive about using his authority to loosen immigration policy rather than tighten it. During his first months in office, he expanded asylum, paused deportations, expanded parole, and that these policies combined with Biden's welcoming rhetoric during the 2020 campaign contributed to the migration surge that we're seeing right now. Is there something useful in looking back and picking apart what didn't go well and didn't go right to help us shape our immigration policy going forward?
We have decades of material, decades of content to work with on that, right? We can go back through the last four or five presidencies and find things that didn't work well.
But do voters have a right to hold Biden accountable in this moment?
Of course they have the right to. I mean, that's what elections are all about. I'm one of the first to say I think that this administration was too slow to acknowledge the challenges at the border, because here's the problem. If I may oversimplify it for a moment, immigration and the border are not necessarily the same conversation. Securing the border is a different conversation than what is the right immigration policy for our country. But that's not how the political realities we live in. That's not how that works, right? You've got Republicans who want to conflate those two issues and say, when they talk immigration, they only want to talk the border. You've got Democrats who want to talk about all of the other things, but don't necessarily want to focus on the border. The reality is there has to be, right? I mean, we talked about this, what was it, Sarah, about a decade ago when there were people in both parties actually talking about comprehensive immigration reform that had leadership, that had people like Marco Rubio on the right and a lot of people on the left stepping forward and saying we have to have an all-in approach to tackling this. We can't do that anymore, right? Marco Rubio has walked away from his own approach to immigration. So, yeah, I mean, we can sit here and say the president didn't do everything. He didn't acknowledge the problem at the border soon enough, while the president was actually off trying to tackle some of the other issues, deploying the vice president to focus on the root cause of migration, trying to stop it before it even got to the border, or trying to address the reasons why so many people were seeking asylum before they even got to the border. But the challenge is complicated. It is comprehensive. We don't treat it that way. And we live in an era that is defined by cable news and social media, which makes it so much harder to focus on the complicated nuances of this problem.
We'll come back and keep talking about this, and then we're going to move on to a new federal nutrition program that has been designed to help kids make sure they're getting the food they need during the summer. We're coming back with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we are back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. I was just asking Mo about whether voters can hold President Biden accountable when it comes to his immigration policy and the situation we're seeing right now. Let's pick up there, Sarah. Any thoughts or things you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of mentioned this briefly, but immigration is now the number one issue for voters, and it's been sustained there for quite some time. It's 21%, according to the latest Gallup poll. That is just staggering compared to where these things normally are. And look, there's no one way to translate the causality between what's the most important issue facing the country right now and who do you support in the upcoming presidential election. But I don't think it's a coincidence that immigration's number one And Pennsylvania, Trump plus 6. Nevada, Trump plus 6. Wisconsin, Trump plus 4. Michigan, Trump plus 2. North Carolina, Trump plus 9. Arizona, Trump plus 6. Georgia, Trump plus 6. These are outside the margin of error in almost every single one of those states except Michigan. Yikes.
Yikes, meaning you think Biden is in deep trouble when it comes to immigration and might lose these states because of this issue?
I think immigration is very much part of the driver of that, and that, you know, Republicans not compromising on the immigration bill, not giving Biden a win, politically was in their interest. Again, we can complain that voters are rewarding that behavior, but the proof is sort of in this polling pudding,
if you will. We'll see about that point. I'm not disagreeing that that might be the point. I'm just not sure we've got the data to prove that it is the point yet, because I do think, and we're starting to see some polling that hasn't translated down to the state level yet. We are seeing some polling that is showing public opinion turning against, or at least starting to turn against Republicans, that voters, particularly independent voters, are starting to turn against Republicans for blocking the border bill. You know as well as I that it oftentimes takes a while for current events to trickle down to state level polling. So I think we will start to see in the coming weeks and months whether or not that has staying power. But I think that is the best bet for the Biden campaign. What the Biden campaign has been signaling what they're going to do is saying, you know what, for whatever reason you want to blame me for where this is, I at least took a stand, found a bipartisan solution that Republicans were ready to sign off on, and Donald Trump killed it. You want to talk solutions? Let's talk solutions.
Well, I'll just add, I mean, the argument, hey, it was on the other party and they messed it up, I feel like it doesn't always resonate that well with voters. That said, Mo, I agree with you. A, it's a solid argument because that's exactly what happened here. I mean, Biden went out on a limb and tried to do the right thing, the hardest thing that, you know, a really hard thing that might have made a difference at the border. And because of Donald Trump, it was scuttled. And I think he has a good argument. The question is whether that message actually lands with voters. And as you say, we're going to see as we follow the polls in all these swing states. But I want to move on to one more issue. And it's really the question I have. Why say no thank you to a program that has been designed to help kids in your state? And that's what I want to dig into as we go into our 50 states segment today. This is our project where we're trying to visit a story in each of the 50 states in this election year to kind of reflect on a local story, a local issue, and see what we can extrapolate and what we can learn about our national politics. So the Department of Agriculture announced the expansion of this federal summer grocery benefits program. It's meant to reduce child hunger during the summer, and it would provide families with an additional $40 per eligible child to spend on groceries while school is out. The benefit can be used at summer meal sites or alongside SNAP and WIC benefits at stores. It's an optional program, and 14 states have decided they don't want to opt in. And one of those states is Louisiana. So the Republican governor there, Jeff Landry, his office said that the summer EBT program is a pandemic era related program, and the pandemic is over. They also said there are other robust social safety net programs available to Louisiana families. And the state's Department of Education explained this a bit more, saying that it was improper to commit the governor and state lawmakers to millions of dollars in increased spending towards a new government program. So this saying no to money for kids was pretty baffling to some people, as we've been hearing on Fox 8 in New Orleans.
In a letter sent to the secretary of the Louisiana Department of Children and Family Services, New Orleans City Council President Helena Moreno requests reconsideration of the state's rejection of the USDA's Summer Electronic Benefits Transfer Program, a program that would provide $40 per eligible child per month just during summer break. Moreno says 2 out of 5 kids in New Orleans are living in poverty, the majority in single mother households.
Beyond disappointing. But, you know, we have recently seen that the governor of Nebraska, who originally rejected this offer as well, has now changed his mind.
Moreno is asking whether there's a limited opt-in option, suggesting the state could only assist the cities that want the assistance. The federal government first studied this through a pilot program, trying it in a couple of states and Indian territories.
So, Sarah, I want to start with you. Here's my question. Like, I completely understand both sides of a debate over government spending and over a policy like this. If you want to talk about it, like, you know, in Congress and debate whether, you know, it's a good use of spending. I mean, how to best support families who need food. I, for one, think this sounds like a great program. But once it's available and there, what is the reasoning for saying no? Like, what is the downside if you're the governor of Louisiana?
So let me back up for a second, because the governor of Louisiana, for what it's worth, was a Democrat up until January, in fact, when they were considering this program. And governors, by and large, we haven't seen the extreme partisanship that we've seen, for instance, in Congress. Voters do seem to vote differently when it's at sort of that gubernatorial level or state level than we've seen in Senate races and congressional races, where the fear is always about the primary and getting flanked from your right or your left. And so just because we had that whole conversation on Mitch McConnell and immigration, I want to sort of level set that this actually is more surprising. It would be less surprising, frankly, if it were in Congress, because you could see, you know, well, it's because of primary ads. It's because they'll get attacked from their own side, et cetera. I do think that governors are very wary of federal encroachment in general. Obviously, this program notwithstanding in some ways, because as you said, it's a pretty sympathetic sounding program. But, you know, these all the money comes with strings attached. And the second you take the money and then your, you know, citizens are used to having that money, it becomes very hard to ever say, well, now we can't have the money because the federal government said we can only continue having the money if we do X, Y, or Z. And we've seen that happen, for instance, with the, this was 10 years ago now, but the Obamacare expansion of Medicaid at states. States were upset about that. And they were like, oh, well, if you don't do this, then we take away Medicaid. And that was a disaster for states politically. Now, they ended up winning that case at the Supreme Court. But during COVID, we saw other strings attached related to vaccinations. Like, well, if you want this money, now there's vaccine requirements. Again, something that states didn't want. And so in some ways, it is impressive to me that states are learning, don't take the money if you don't want the strings, even if the money sounds really sympathetic, or accept that there's going to be strings attached from a federal government, and particularly that comes from an executive branch that's going to decide what those strings are. So if you don't want Biden deciding the strings, or if you don't want Trump deciding the strings, don't take the money.
I guess I can see that argument if we were still having the same argument, that we had a couple of decades ago, right? When we were actually, when the size and scope of government was the primary driver of what of our politics, but I don't think it is anymore. I don't think that's what's motivating most of our politics anymore. And it is so interesting to me to see the arguments that are being used, at least the public arguments that are being used by some of those who are rejecting this funding. Well, COVID is over, okay, but childhood hunger isn't. Well, look at, you know, let's attack Joe Biden for the high cost of inflation. Okay, here's a program that would make it easier for parents to feed their children. And you look at the things that they say government should not be involved in, right? Whichever governor it was that says, I'm against welfare, which is essentially saying the government should not be involved in some of these issues. But at the same time, they're coming in the same states that are the most interested in dictating what can happen with a woman's uterus. Right. Like, if you are going to, and you hear this refrain often from child advocates in a number of states, like, okay, you can say you're pro-life, you can say that families, you know, that we should be supporting families, then freaking support the families, then give the aid to the families that need that help, because here it is being handed to you. Here's an opportunity being handed to you to help our children. You'd much rather score the political points on other issues than focus on this. And that's creating a sense of anger. Having said that, the politics of this aren't really going to be all that compelling, right? Because the states where this is happening are primarily in red states. And you're just not seeing the same kind of uproar over this issue in red states that you would be seeing if this were to happen in a blue state somewhere.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Let's move on to our left, right, and center rants and raves before we go. Mo, I'll let you dive in first.
In the category of are you absolutely kidding me? Missouri has a governor's race coming up. And in the competitive race for the Republican nomination for governor, there are a number of candidates. But one of the leading candidates, the one whose name may sit atop the ballot, Daryl Leon McClanahan, news broke this week that he was once a member of the KKK. Not long ago was a member of the KKK. Now, what's really astonishing to me was the response that came from it. In threatening to hold the accuser liable, he said, no, I was never a card-carrying member of the KKK who attended cross burnings. I was just an honorary member of the KKK, and I didn't attend a church, a cross burning. I attended a religious cross lighting ceremony. Now, I'm a former comms guy, and so maybe that's what's coloring this for me, but I literally could not think of a worse response than to say, no, I didn't choose to be a member of the KKK. They just liked me so much that they gave me an honorary membership, and then to try to come up with a unique framing for a cross burning, I thought was unique. So, folks, keep an eye out on this Missouri governor's race and whether or not the honorary member with the who participates in religious cross lighting ceremonies will get any traction out of this.
Sarah.
I feel like Mo and I in our operative days were never so creative as that.
I know, right?
I mean, really, we're being put to shame. Like, you're just embarrassed that you never were able to spin that.
Please don't be that creative. Please don't be that creative.
I'm really not embarrassed that I never said that.
I've got a rant about people who are ranting about the Supreme Court agreeing to hear the case on Donald Trump's immunity from criminal prosecution. First of all, if you're upset about the delay, don't blame the Supreme Court. Blame the Department of Justice, who took 2.5 years to indict this case from January 6, 2021. Or you can blame Judge Chutkan, the trial judge, who also took time ruling on motions, including the same amount of time, by the way, that the Supreme Court's going to take now on the back end here. I'm very frustrated with sort of just blaming the person who holds the potato at the end of the game instead of all the people who held on to the potato earlier in the game. And look, remember, Jack Smith, the special counsel, asked the Supreme Court to decide this question earlier. He didn't even tell the Supreme Court not to take it this time. So everyone was agreed that the Supreme Court should be the one to decide this question. Stop blaming the Supreme Court. Stop calling them MAGA extremists. This is what our Supreme Court does. It decides important questions for the country. They're doing it on an expedited basis, much faster than any other criminal defendant would have his case decided. If you were a normal criminal defendant who had filed this appeal at the Supreme Court, it would not be heard until November of next year and not decided until more than a year from now. So stop with the ranting. Stop tearing down our institutions unless you actually know what you're talking about, which so far, I don't see a lot of people.
I'm going to rave about estate sales because you never know what you're going to find there. A few weeks ago, I was reading police outside Seattle were called to inspect this guy's garage because reportedly there was a military-grade rocket there. The Associated Press said that this resident had passed away but had bought this rocket from an estate sale, and this was not just any rocket. This was an air-to-air rocket that was designed to carry a nuclear warhead, and it was being used by the United States and Canada during the Cold War. Police, thank goodness, made sure to mention that there was no warhead at the moment in this person's garage and no rocket fuel, so they said it was not a danger, and they were cool leaving it with a neighbor to donate to a military museum. Let's all go to an estate sale together sometime soon.
I'm not going to go if I can't buy the rocket, David. What's the point?
I mean, there might be another rocket sitting there. Just don't buy the warhead. Okay, Mo, Sarah, thank you as always. And that's our show for today. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green, and our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. And the show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. And Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. And Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. And we're distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Please come back next week. We're going to bring you more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.